of the texts that we read in our freshman math curriculum is Euclid's Elements, and this is an image from a Vatican Library edition of Euclid's Elements, of Euclid's Proposition 147, which you may know as Pythagorean Theorem. So you can see the squares, these two squares equal this square. Those are the equalities in that proposition. So we study Euclid's Elements with our freshmen. And what we do in that class is we read Euclid and we study the propositions and we study the postulates and common notions that underlie the geometric propositions that he presents. And we understand the technical proofs that he gives for propositions like 147 that allow us to demonstrate that the two squares on the sides of the triangle are equal to the square on the side of the hypotenuse. So we do a lot of technical work, and our students do proofs, and they get used to speaking in the language of geometry and mathematics. You can always tell who's teaching freshman math because there's a lot of chalk covered on them in the hallways. And so I think that when they get to the Pythagorean theorem, which is fairly early on in this semester, there is this really wonderful moment when they realize that there are these geometrical underpinnings for the algebra that they're familiar with from high school. Most of them, although not all of them, haven't come into contact with geometric proofs before, and so their version of this is a squared plus b squared equals c squared. And some of them realize for the first time that those little twos are actually really squares. There is a visual geometric counterpart to this algebraic account. So the book opens up this experience. It's a technical experience of being able to reconstruct the language of mathematics and reason that way, and to feel the sense that the proof actually locks in something that is true about the figures that they're looking at. The experience also shows them that there are other languages that they can use to speak about the mathematics that they've come into contact with. And for many of them, mathematics becomes interesting. Later on in the curriculum, we study Euclidean geometry and the world in which parallel lines can meet. And so they meet the claim the parallel lines don't meet in Euclid, and by the end of the curriculum, they have a new account of how their spatial intuitions work, that in some worlds, on curved surfaces, for example, parallel lines can meet. So they have this experience that brings them into a new mathematical world. One of the other things that we do in the mathematics curriculum is an astronomy sequence, and we start with this strange book called Ptolemy's Almagest, which is the book that is the foundation for the geocentric universe. So for people from the outside, they think that up at St. John's, they teach them that the Earth is at the center. And it's sort of funny because once you've completed the sophomore year, you sort of think in Ptolemaic terms. And I remember when I was first teaching in that curriculum, I was really good at understanding what was going on in the sky with Ptolemy. And I went out on a date with this guy who was an astronomer. And I started to realize that I was going to ask him some questions about the moon because we hadn't really covered the moon yet and how its epicycles worked. And then I realized that I probably shouldn't talk about that to him because he would realize that I was secretly a Ptolemaic thinker. So we read Ptolemy and we dive in, and this is an image from the Almagest where you can see some of the diagrams that Ptolemy uses to explain the appearances of the sky to us using epicycles. The astronomy sequence moves from Ptolemy to Galileo, so we work through Copernicus, Kepler, and Galileo, and when we start reading Ptolemy, one of the first things that we do is we say, okay, we're gonna read Ptolemy, but first we've got to go and look at the sky. So we take everybody outside in the daytime, and we say, where does the sun rise? And does it rise in the same place every morning? If you're standing in the same place, is it going to come up on the horizon? And some of them, for the first time, realize that no, it doesn't. And then you say, well, does it reach the center of the sky, the zenith, at any point in the year? And some of them say, well, I'm not sure. And you know, they sort of have to think through what does the sun look like over the course of the day. We also take them out at night. We have telescopes, but at this point, we just look at the appearances of the stars from the perspective of the naked eye. And in that context, They start to realize that you can't see all the constellations at all times, that the stars seem to look like they're traveling around the North Star every night, and some stars you can see every night, others you can't. So they start to get to know the sky from the perspective of the naked eye, from the human perspective, unmediated by any instrumentation. And when they do this, they start to sort of expand their world. I think they start to sort of understand why farmers care about the sky and what the Farmer's Almanac is all about. And their grandfathers suddenly become more interesting to them because they were sailing on ships and, you know, were sort of interested in astronomical coordinates. So I think that even though this is kind of a strange place to put them in, to sort of think about what the appearances look like from an Earth-centered perspective, it starts to connect them to the larger cosmos that they're living in from the position of their own vantage point, the one that they can see if they just look outside. Now, one of the strange things that happens when we start to get tired of Ptolemy is that people go on the internet and they start to look at diagrams of what the Ptolemaic universe looks like if we're looking at it from a perspective that is outside of his system, outside of the Earth, and outside of the planetary system that his theory is based on. And people start to look at images like this one. This is not in Ptolemy, just for the record. This is a different image. And they say, well, you know, in Ptolemy's world, if we actually trace the path of the planets, they must be going in these loop-de-loop things like this. And that's just weird. I mean, what are we in, like, Spirograph world or something? And they say, well, this is just dumb. They can't be doing that. They sort of get down on Ptolemy. Like, how come he didn't think about this? And I think one of the reasons is that he really is thinking from that perspective of the human eye, from the perspective of Earth. So they start to get itchy about that. They want to look at Earth from the other perspective, and they look at these kinds of diagrams. And they often go on YouTube and look at the way that people have reconstructed different kinds of systems. One of the favorites of late is a model in which someone demonstrated that if you have an epicyclical system, you can create a pattern of planetary motion that looks like Homer Simpson. And yet, from the Earth perspective, it just looks like the planets over the course of the year are traveling around us with some retrograde motion. In Homer, there's a lot more retrograde motion. But it's basically, you know, it's possible. So they get sort of down on Ptolemy. And so we finally get them to Copernicus. And they're pretty happy to be there. And one of the things that they see when they start reading Copernicus is this diagram. This is a sun-centric diagram. It's one where Copernicus basically takes something that is similar to Ptolemaic mathematics and says, well, what if we take the point that is currently the Earth, and instead we place the sun there? What would the planetary motion look like if we did that? And there's this kind of shift, and the reversal moves from something that looks like this to something that looks like this. Now, of course, if you've read your Kepler, you know that we are not dealing with planets that travel in perfect concentric circles. But this is sort of the beginning of that move. This is the beginning of starting to think about the planets moving around us, not in epicycles. Although Copernicus uses a lot of epicycles in his own system. When we get to this stage, I think what happens also is that the students start to enter into another interesting world, which is a world of apparent contradictions and theoretical flux. One of the interesting things about Copernicus and the Copernican world before Kepler and Galileo is that we can't judge with the naked eye which of these two systems more accurately reflects the phenomena. So it's kind of an equivocal cosmological world. It could be the case that the Earth is at the center. It could be the case that the sun is at the center. And there are even astronomers that try to develop a system that combines both, like Tycho Brahe. So they go through another set of technical projects when we're working on Ptolemy and Copernicus. They learn how to do the technical work of understanding planetary motion, and they connect their understanding of what's going on with the sky with the idea that there are mathematical patterns that we can observe in the world and describe, and we can use a mathematical geometric language to talk about them. I think they also find themselves situated in a very interesting theoretical place, that the world seems to be presenting them contradictions, and we don't have the empirical evidence to determine which of those is true. I think that is also something that is very similar to the situation that they find themselves in now, when they've leave with this, the end of the senior year, and they're sort of left with all of the questions that are still lingering about atomic physics and evolutionary biology. They're sort of situated in a world where there are still questions and contradictions that are yet to be resolved, and we don't have the tools yet to solve them. While they are doing astronomy, they're also moving through the history of biology. And so they've now dissected all of their creatures or drawn other versions if they're not dissecting. And they move into the realm of microscopy. So in this context, we turn to van Leeuwenhoek, who is the first microscopist and the first person to observe bacteria. And we look at a lot of what we look at are his images and drawings. We also look at Robert Hooke's drawings, but we start with Leeuwenhoek. Leeuwenhoek is kind of a funny character because he wasn't really a scientist by training. I think he was a curtain maker, and he made these lenses in order to be able to look at buttons and textures to see if the quality of fabric was any good. And then he suddenly realized that he could see other stuff that we couldn't see before, so his lenses were really sharp. And when he started to see this other stuff, he sent a letter to the Royal Society and said, you know, I saw these little animals in my water. There are little animals in my water. I'll call them animalcules. I think this is a great title for a children's book, by the way. The animalcules. So animalcules, he saw these animalcules, and the Royal Society didn't believe him. There's nothing in your water. This guy, he's crazy, this crazy curtain maker. So finally, for some reason, he sent somebody out to observe his lenses and what he was seeing. And because he wouldn't give them to anyone else, he realized he had something and he was going to keep it for a while. So they sent some people out and they found them and they verified his claims. And the Royal Society then said, please write us more letters. So he wrote reams of letters about his observations. And in those letters, we have this diagram, which is the first instance of bacteria. So this is from Leeuwenhoek's teeth. He dug the plaque out of his teeth and looked at it. And lo and behold, there they were. So when we're reading Leeuwenhoek's diagrams, and also even in the wake of the dissections, I think we start to kind of come up against this really visceral experience of looking at the world. And I think, you know, there's something kind of gross about microscopy in some ways at first, but then they get really fascinated. So they move from this kind of, you know, visceral physical experience into something that's really fascinating through the lens that they're looking at. They look at their own blood sometimes, and they look at their own teeth whatever else I don't always ask. But they Leeuwenhoek too did look at all kinds of bodily fluids. He was fascinated by everything. So they also get fascinated by everything that they can see. And I think when they move into the microscopy world and they start to look at images and see what they're seeing themselves, their visual universe really expands. And they realize that not only is there a sort of distance between the world of the heavens that they're seeing and the appearances in front of them and what's behind them, there's also kind of an interesting distance between what they're seeing with the naked eye and what the microscope starts to open up. I think that one of the things that is also really striking about the biological curriculum is that we look at drawings, and I think we start to see a connection between art and science. There is obviously a very rigid distinction between the arts and the sciences in the university, but I think anyone who looks at the history of something like microbiology can't deny that artists and drawings are very prominent in that world. We also very quickly get into the world of diagrams and representations of biological phenomena that we can't observe with the eye. It's not long before the things that we can observe with the eye, with either the telescope or the microscope, only become things that we can observe mathematically. So the mathematics then becomes a language that we speak in. And we also start to rely on diagrams and representations of those mathematics. And reading those diagrams, I think, really brings up a lot of philosophical questions about how we're understanding the phenomenon that we're looking at. If we can only observe it mathematically, what does that mean about what we're seeing when we're seeing a diagram? I would love to hear, and I don't know, but my suspicion is that there is something like a trend of looking at the history of science in terms of diagrams. It seems like in the last few years, a lot of books have been published that are really interested in that question. And I think that this kind of experience with what it means to look at a diagram that represents a scientific claim is a really fascinating philosophical area to inhabit. So I'd love to hear more about whether you think that is true, and if indeed it is true, what it says about our experience with reading science. Now, I would be remiss if I went through my whole talk and I only showed you diagrams of scientific stuff and mathematics, and I didn't actually talk about something more traditional to our program. And so I thought I would close and talk a little bit about Greek tragedy. So I have this very, very delightful quotation from the choral ode from Oedipus. This is what they say after he has appeared on stage with his eyes torn out at the horror of his life. Woe, woe, unhappy one, I can't even look at you, though there are many things I want to ask, to discover, to gaze at. Such is the shuddering you inspire. Okay, why did I do this on a Saturday morning after talking about Leeuwenhoek and his teeth? Okay, well, what I'm up to here is that I want to just end by talking a little bit about the experience of reading Greek tragedy, because I think that that is also one of the most striking experiences that I've had for understanding how the texts that we read really show the very fascinating and dynamic character of reading. So if you've come across Oedipus, or at least some kind of summary version of it, you know that Oedipus is the hero of Sophocles' tragedy, possibly his greatest tragedy, and he is awarded a kingship in Thebes because he has left his hometown out of fear that he will kill his father and marry his mother. An oracle said, you know, you will do this in your life. So he flees, and on his way, he kills a man at a crossroads, just incidentally, and sort of doesn't, you know, for some reason connect those two events in any way. And then he runs into a sphinx, and the sphinx poses a riddle to him. What goes on two legs, and then what goes on four legs, on two legs, and on three legs? And of course, the answer is a man. Who over the course of his life moves from crawling to walking with a cane. Okay, so Oedipus solves the riddle of the Sphinx, slays the Sphinx, and as a reward, he wins Thebes. Thebes, of course, is mourning the death of its king, who died at a crossroads because somebody murdered him. And he also gets to marry the Theban queen, who also happens to be his mother. Okay, so things don't go well from here. He doesn't know this yet. He doesn't know this yet. And over the course of the play, we watch him investigate, and we watch the whole thing unfold as he comes to the realization of the situation that he's in. We also read Aristotle in that context, and Aristotle gives us an account of the emotional experience that we're going through when we're watching a tragedy. Aristotle tells us in his Poetics that when we're watching a tragedy, we go through a set of emotions. First, fear. We're sort of fearful for the character. Don't do it, Oedipus. Don't ask. You don't want to know. And then we feel pity for him when he starts to realize the situation that he's in. And Aristotle says, at this point, this excites our wonder. When we talk about these, we talk about how, you know, there are some books that have sort of too much fear and some books that have too much pity. And one of my colleagues has an account of this. He says that, you know, the books that have too much pity are tearjerkers and the books that have too much fear are like horror movies. But somehow tragedy is sort of balancing these two emotional poles, and then it excites our wonder for some reason. When we first start talking about tragedy and how it works, one of the things that students start to do is they start to say, you know, that Oedipus, he deserved it. The moral of the story is just don't ask. Tiresias told you, don't ask. You don't want to know what's really going on, and it's your own fault for asking. So he sort of, and some of them say, well, you know, Oedipus, he's kind of got an anger problem. He's really mad all the time, and he kills this guy on the crossroads, and they, you know, they ignore the fact that the guy was going to attack him, and you know there was a threat. So they sort of want to have a moral of the story. They want to say Oedipus deserved what he got, and the gods are punishing him, and he deserved it. And then some of them say, well, wouldn't you want to know if somebody told you that you killed your father and married your mother? Wouldn't you want to, you know, like get 23andMe and find out for sure if, you know, if you're really who you think you are? And isn't there a kind of a compulsion of reason to want to know? Can we really blame him for that? Of course, all the while, he also thinks that he's investigating the cause of a plague in the city. And it's just the fact that these things converge. So then the conversation kind of gets more complicated. And the students, I think, start to realize that the tragedy is not a neat moral universe, and their moral universe needs to expand. And so I think at this point, this is when the wonder starts to come in. They start to ask about the role of the gods in the plays and whether the Greeks believed their gods or not. Could they really have believed them? And some of them say, well, absolutely, it's Athena. I mean, how could you not? And so they start to wonder about the character of the universe and the character of necessity. They wonder about how far Oedipus has control over his own life and how far he doesn't. And they wonder why Sophocles would put a person on stage to suffer like this. Aeschylus, another Greek tragedian, has this chorus tell us that we must suffer into the truth. And I think when we read Sophocles, this becomes sort of acute because it's very difficult to see what the truth is in Sophocles. He leaves us with a lot of moral uncertainty. I put the quote from Sophocles up here because it's my favorite passage in Oedipus. And it's a very interesting moment because the chorus, I think, imitates our own experience with the dramas when we've arrived at this moral uncertainty. They are sort of horrified and disgusted at Oedipus because he's taken out his eyes when he's realized the situation that he's in. And they also are very curious. They want to know. They do want to look at him with their own eyes. But they also are horrified, and there's something repugnant about what he's done. And they're curious. So I think that they're curious and horrified. And so it's kind of this mix of experiences. So again, I think that experience of reading is one in which the book really opens their moral universe in the same way that a lot of the astronomical and mathematical texts open up the cosmological universe. So in the end, I think our attachment to books is not exactly a matter of being attached to codexes. I think it's an attachment to a tradition that is delivered to us through these codexes and that we are connected to. I think what it means to be a reader, for at least in this context, and I think in just about any place where we get really engaged with a book, whatever kind of a book it may be, is one in which the book kind of opens up a new world to us, but it also connects us to our own world, our own position in the cosmos, whether it's a moral position, a technical position, a cosmological position. So I think reading at its heart is a really dynamic activity, and I think it can be experienced in different ways. And I think the books that are the finest ones, the best ones, my favorites on the program and in the world, are the ones that take us into another place physically and in all of these different ways that I think some of the books move us. So I think when we start to see that even these stodgy old codexes, these books that come from the Vatican Library with funny diagrams and backwards writing, even when we sort of see that those books can have this kind of dynamic experience, I think it can also give us heart that the world will always have people who like to read them, and there is always the possibility of replicating that dynamic tradition for books in the years to come. Thank you very much.
Thank you.